Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the developing relationship between America and Palestine, as it was in 1946, and then later the State of Israel after 1948, and the impact that the Holocaust and the fate of the Jews in Europe had on Harry Truman and American public opinion in general. Now, one of the texts that I'm drawing from at the moment is Victor Sebastian's 1946, a really interesting set of vignettes of the year 1946, in which he contends that the post-war era was really born. This is a very significant and important year. You know, a claim you can make about any year, really, in the 20th century. There's never a dull moment, really. But it is a very kind of compelling read, and one well worth having draw into, because the kind of the eclecticism of the topics covered. The story begins with the dispatch of a group of American relief workers to Europe, led by one Earl Harrison. Harrison had been a dean of Pennsylvania University Law School. He was a Methodist, teetotal, a Roosevelt supporter, but a Republican to boot, and had served in the war as the Commissioner of Immigration and Naturalization. He was the ideal character for Truman to send to Europe. Now, previously, if you've listened to this podcast, I've talked about Truman in the years sort of 45 to 47 as having quite a weak grasp on world events. When we talk about the foundations of the CIA, one of the reasons for its creation in the first place, or the creation of an information service, which is really what Truman was looking for, was that Truman was not a foreign policy expert in any way to the level that Roosevelt had been, and required diligent and reliable sources of information. Harrison was one of those to some extent. Harrison went to Europe. Some very bleak reports about the fate of Jewish people in Europe. Some of them were riddled with inaccuracies. Some of them had a number of painful home truths to tell. Harrison was chosen for this task because before the war, during the 1930s, he had raised money to help Jews escape Nazi Germany and resettle in the US. And he had done this as a church man, a Methodist, who was working through Christian charities to help persecuted Jewish people. In 1945, or 1946, was not high on the list of priorities of Harry Truman or any other Western leader. The fact of the matter was that both Truman and Churchill and later Attlee were well aware that there were abundant anti-Semites in America and Britain, and it was important to not encourage the belief that the war had been fought in the interests of Jewry. There's a very interesting book, I've mentioned it before, Thinking the 20th Century, conversations between Tony Judd and Timothy Snyder. And Tony Judd has some very revealing things to say about a Jewish life in Britain in the 1950s, growing up a Jewish boy in Britain and experiencing more anti-Semitism than most British people were comfortable admitting actually existed. And the same was true in the USA. So Harry Truman was not, the Jews were not high on Harry Truman's list of priorities, and Truman was aware, obviously well aware, of the Holocaust, but it had not by any means in the late 1940s moved centre stage in American public discourse whatsoever. The excellent book, The Holocaust Industry and Beyond Chutzpah by Norman Finkelstein, makes the point that actually the main civic bodies within Jewish American life wanted to be slightly distant from the question of Israel. There was an anxiety that the Jews had been murdered en masse in Europe, and similar things could happen anywhere. They could potentially happen in America if the Jews were made to feel unwelcome enough. And tying one's colours to a foreign power, and in the tumult of the early days of the Cold War, it was not abundantly clear that Israel would become an American satellite. It might rather unfortunately become a Soviet one, and then American Jews would be tarred by American anti-Semites as being intimately connected with a new Soviet satellite in the Middle East. So, understandably, senior figures within the American Jewish community were very cautious about Israel to begin with, and about, before Israel, about Jewish migration to the British Mandate of Palestine. Because of Truman's lack of knowledge of the conditions and the realities of Jewish life in Europe after the Holocaust, Harrison was able to exert a great deal of influence over Truman. Harrison, as mentioned, sent back hard-hitting reports, and he said essentially that the US should support a Jewish state, that's a Jewish homeland, as was the wording of the Balfour Declaration, which allowed for Jewish migration into Palestine originally from 1917 onwards, said that there could be a Jewish homeland, and it was suitably ambiguous as to what that meant. Classic bit of British imperial diplomacy and doublespeak. Here Harrison said that there needed to be a Jewish state, and this would put quite a lot of pressure on Anglo-American relationships at the end of the war. And some of the shocking accounts of how Jews were still being prevented from leaving Europe to go to Palestine, and the camp conditions in which they were kept. There were many Jews who were still in the camps that had imprisoned them, the concentration and not the death camps, they were destroyed or occupied by the Soviets, but the camps such as Bergen-Belsen and Sachsenhausen were then used, turned into essentially displaced person camps, ones with particularly hideous memories for the Jewish people who were stuck there. He said, "As matters now stand, we appear to be treating the Jews as the Nazis treated them, except that we do not exterminate them." I would say that this is a wild exaggeration. It's true that the British were quite heavy-handed with Jewish evacuees who attempted to reach Palestine, who were turned back and had to be housed in Europe somewhere. The out-of-use camps such as Sachsenhausen were reopened, and Jewish prisoners were kept there. And when they rioted in one particular notorious incident, the British soldiers actually turned fire hoses on them. Now, one would be forgiven for thinking that the sole reason for Jewish people leaving Europe was the memory of the recent Holocaust. Well, that's not quite the case. The idea that Jewish people were leaving Europe in large numbers because of a horrific event which they had survived isn't the full picture. The reality was, in not just Eastern but Western European countries as well, violence, murder, assault and robbery were being perpetrated on Jewish people still by civilian populations and newly liberated governments, and the Jewish people of Europe, with some degree of justification, felt that Europe was not a safe place for them, even though the Nazis had been vanquished. This really accounts for, between 1945 and 1948, the outflow of really most of the remaining diaspora Jews from Europe. Some of Harrison's reports were full of inaccuracies. He seemed to think that there had been gas chambers at Belsen. There hadn't. Belsen was many things, but it wasn't a death camp. It was a concentration camp that, at the end of the war, becomes full of Jewish prisoners who'd survived Auschwitz-Birkenau and had been marched westwards. And the huge influx of prisoners led to a mass outbreak of disease, and that was one of the main killers in the last days at Bergen-Belsen, not Zyklon B gas. So you have to wonder how valid some of the things that Harrison was saying actually are. He said, "Many Jewish refugees are living under guard behind barbed wire fences in camps of several descriptions, including some of the most notorious, amidst crowded and sanitary conditions, in complete idleness with no opportunity except surreptitiously to communicate with the outside world, waiting, hoping for some word of encouragement and action on their behalf." And Harrison was explicit in what he wrote. He said that the Jewish people are a nation and they should be treated as such. The reality for many Jews across Europe is that their sense of national identity had been Greek or Polish or Dutch or German, and this had been how they had seen themselves. Primo Levi famously wrote, the Italian Jewish Holocaust survivor, famously wrote at the end of the Holocaust, the end of the war, when he made it back to Turin, that he had been an Italian before the war, but now, because of the Nazis, he could be nothing other than a Jew. His ability to feel welcome or assimilated into another nation state was gone, and all he was left with was his Jewish identity, which was one that he had really subsumed in favour of a more integrated Italian sense of self. If that belief by Harrison is correct, and it seems like a broad oversimplification without asking hundreds of thousands of Jewish people how they viewed themselves in a sense of nationhood, it's difficult to know. But other avenues of nationhood had certainly been stripped away from a great many Jewish people. When they went home to their countries of origin, they were still told by many civilians there who had been occupied by the Nazis, "We don't want you, you're not welcome." Of course, not in all cases, but it was quite prevalent. Harrison made a recommendation in his report to Truman, which was problematic for Truman and almost impossible to resolve for the British. He said that 100,000 Jews should be admitted to Palestine immediately. The problem that the British had was that since 1917, mass Jewish immigration into Palestine had led to an Arab revolt which had to be mercilessly suppressed, and then the banning of Jewish migration into Palestine from 1937 onwards resulted in a low level, and then towards the end of the war, increasingly high level guerrilla warfare waged by Irgun and the Stern Gang and others.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Such organisations, the most significant figure behind those being obviously Menachem Begin. Now, I did do a podcast a long time ago on Menachem Begin, and you can look it up, but he'll definitely be making a reappearance fairly shortly. Harrison's 100,000 figure seems to have been plucked from thin air, and he had not really been able to speak to large numbers of Jewish people in the camps. He interacted with a few Jewish leaders, but he didn't know anything about Palestine. He was unable to comment whether Palestine could absorb 100,000 new immigrants, and he didn't seem to know anything about the Arab revolt before the before the Second World War. So the figures that were being sent to a largely impressionable Truman, who was quite taken in by what Harrison had to say, were hypothetical at best. Harrison, who doesn't seem to have liked the British very much, didn't make any effort to speak to British officials in Germany or Palestine, certainly didn't speak to any Arabs, and he was largely unconcerned, it would appear, with the question of Arab nationhood in Palestine. He saw things in terms of a simple moral solution, which you can forgive the man for wanting, having seen the condition of Jewish people in camps and the kind of the stain on the world's conscience. It's entirely possible that he believed that there were simple moral solutions, but obviously there weren't. The entire question of what to do with Palestine was incredibly complicated. The British had got themselves into an appalling mess there due to the various problems created from the Balfour Declaration onwards. And short of washing their hands of it, and I've done a number of podcasts on this one, about the partition of Palestine. I did that one a couple of months ago. The British have no better ideas. So the idea that Harrison, with his limited knowledge, was going to simply call a solution is pretty naive. Rather unfortunately, then, the 100,000 figure became adopted as an article of faith by the Americans. And I don't think Truman looked into where Harrison was getting his statistics from. Truman was moved by Harrison's reports, and certainly Harrison's reports put the question of Palestine in the centre of Truman's thinking, whereas it had once been not even a kind of a periphery question. However, Truman's a hard-headed guy, And Truman had not a magnificent record in treating Jewish people with civility, just as he was a more than casual racist when it came to black Americans. Truman was a typical kind of casual anti-Semite of his age, much as Roosevelt had been, referring to smart Hebrews and clever Yids and that kind of thing in his diaries. I remember a particularly choice comment by Roosevelt, who would go to his Hyde Park estate in the summer to get away from all of New York's Negroes and Jews. As was the way with these things, the White House and the State Department were often divided over what to do. The State Department said that the key to controlling the Middle East in the post-war era would be to befriend the Arabs and not to antagonise them. Roosevelt had done a marvellous job with this during the war, had sailed to Saudi Arabia and courted the Saudi royal family to allow America to buy Saudi oil in perpetuity. And the beginnings of a philo-Semitism in America, enthusiasm for the Zionist cause, was just starting to stir at the end of the war. There was a religious dimension to this, the idea that the Holy Land, the children of Israel must be returned to the Holy Land, and that sort of thing. There were in the late 19th, early 20th century in Britain a great many Methodist philo-Semites and Anglican philo-Semites who believed that it was a Christian duty to see the Jews returned to the Holy Land. So it's quite a deep part of culture surrounding certain churches and branches of Protestantism. Anyway, another aspect of this philo-Semitism and in America, and an enthusiasm for the Zionist cause, was a belief that, or as a way of helping Americans to embrace the notion of the good war, that the Jews who had been saved from the Nazis, obviously by the Americans, though, you know, you have to really kind of go into a vast universe of historical fiction to ignore the fact that it was the Red Army that liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau. Anyway, in the minds of the domestic American population, the war had clearly been fought for to end tyranny and defeat the bad guys, and the Jews had been saved, and this was all good. And so, surely Zionism and giving them their own homeland after everything that happened to them was the right thing to do. And Truman centred that this was electorally popular. And Truman, for much of his time in office, was fairly poorly received by the American population. Truman agreed that he would put more pressure on the British to allow immigration into Palestine, and as I said, we've covered this one previously, in the Partition of Palestine podcast. Truman said to Ibn Saud, King of Saudi Arabia, the Roosevelt's old friend, "I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs as my constituents." Now, anti-Semitic narratives have always put it that American presidents are influenced by, you know, sinister Jewish control of America and all this sort of, you know, insane nonsense. The reality is far more mundane than that. The reality is that it wasn't hundreds of thousands of Jews that were putting pressure on Truman, but hundreds of thousands of church-going American Christian people who thought that it was only moral that the Jews should be allowed to immigrate into Palestine. However, Truman was also aware that in certain swing states there were Jewish minorities who could possibly be decisive. There were, in fact, 4.5 million American Jews by 1945, so this is not an inconsiderable demographic. Not all of those are moved by the case of Israel, but a great many are. And Israel and the Zionist movement had really become more important to American Jews throughout the 1930s. The concept of a Zion is obviously always more appealing when you're not in a country that is stable and relatively liberal and relatively prosperous. Jewish people in Poland, for example, in the late 19th, 20th centuries, disputed amongst themselves whether they had indeed found Zion. They were relatively well looked after in Poland, and they lived in a relatively tolerant environment where they felt they could thrive. And Zionists wanting to move to Palestine were often in fierce debate with other Polish Zionists who thought, no, well, we need to stay put. A more cynical way of interpreting America's enthusiasm for Palestine was the fact that immigration to America from Europe was at its lowest level in half a century by 1945. The returning GIs who were coming back from Europe and the Pacific were guaranteed the first bite of the jobs boom that was happening, and the idea that European Jews might flood in and take advantage of America's newfound prosperity was not an attractive thought to many Americans who kept their prejudices quite neatly hidden. So sending them to Palestine, making them the British, the problem for the British, and the British by 1945 certainly don't necessarily have a kind of love affair with the American public, especially during the incident of the Keynes Loan, which, again, I've done a podcast on that if you want to go back and have a look at it, where there was a great deal of resentment that the British should be coming over looking for a cheap loan at the end of the war that America, in the eyes of many Americans, had won for Great Britain. And therefore, with some Anglophobic Americans dumping the problem of Jewish emigration from Europe onto the British Empire was almost a pleasure. Richard Crossman, who later became one of the great figures of the Labour Party in Great Britain during the post-war era, a supporter of Zionism and a supporter of the US, when he visited America in 1946, he said, "The average American supported immigration to Palestine because he didn't want more Jews in America. By shouting for a Jewish state, Americans satisfy many motives. They're attacking the British Empire and British protectionism. They're espousing a moral cause for whose fulfillment they will take no moral responsibility. And most important of all, they are diverting attention from the fact that their own immigration laws are one of the causes of the problem. I was irritated in Washington by the almost complete disregard of the Arab case. Only those very few Americans who had experienced of the Middle East showed any understanding of the problem. The rest seemed to take it as self-evident that once the legal title of the Jews to Palestine had been proved, there was nothing else to discuss. They saw Arabs as they saw native Indians, who were a bar to progress and manifest destiny, who would have to be pushed aside as if modernity and progress were to prevail." But this wasn't just a democratic socialist perspective. Lord Halifax, who was a conservative peer, former conservative foreign secretary, and potential rival for Churchill with Churchill in 1944 for the prime ministership, said, "The average American citizen does not want more Jews in the United States and solves his conscience by advocating their admission into Palestine." Truman wrote to Attlee after having Harrison's report, saying that the British should immediately allow 100,000 Jews into Palestine, and that he was prepared to make his support for a Jewish homeland public. He wrote, "As I said to you in Potsdam, the American people, as a whole, firmly believe that immigration into Palestine should not be closed, that a reasonable number of Europe's persecuted Jews should be permitted to resettle there. Attlee responded by saying that grievous harm could be done to Anglo-US relations by putting out a figure which has been formed without consideration of the consequences for the Middle East. Now, in the next couple of days, I'm going to do a podcast on the Irgun gang and the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. So stay tuned for that. And thanks very much for listening. And if you can, check out our Patreon page and also give us a good write-up on the Explaining History iTunes page. I'd be much obliged. Thanks very much. Catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.